This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones from the Depths of DVD Hell. And of course, joining me from Guerrilla Ramblings and Eastern Kicks is my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me back, Elwood.
Tonight we are obviously celebrating Halloween and we're taking a break from our usual scheduling by doing something a little bit different. Tonight we are going to be holding our Asian horror film draft. And joining us, of course, because who better person could there be if we're talking about Asian horror than our guest tonight? So, of course, it gives me great pleasure to welcome from the host, well, the owner and proprietor of Zobo with Shotgun. It, of course, gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show Zoe Rose Smith. So, welcome to the show, Zoe.
Hello. Thank you for having me once again to talk about everything messed up.
I've had to say, because obviously the area of expertise, shall we say, for yourself is kind of unique in the fact that you tend to specialize in more dark and macabre and quite occasionally disgusting elements of cinema. And it's obviously been one of those areas which obviously first led to us connecting the first time, because you were obviously talking about like the Ebola syndrome and Nikodama and these really bizarre category free Asian cinema films. I mean, what is it about Asian horror that appeals to yourself, Zoe?
I think for me, Asian horror kind of has two sides. First of all, it's the paranormal side. And I'm sure we can talk a lot more about that. But I mean, I first got into Asian cinema when I watched Ju-on. And that was, and still to this day, I will not watch that because it terrified me more than anything's ever terrified me. And then obviously I kind of ventured into watching a lot more Asian horror. And I think the greatest thing is they have no boundaries. Boundaries don't exist. And, you know, if you watch a film like Tokyo Gore Police, it's ridiculous, but it's also amazing. And I think for me, that's the greatest thing about Asian horror films in particular. There's just not a boundary. They push it. They push you to your extreme. And as you said, I love all things macabre. I love everything that goes slightly across the line. And that's why I love it so much.
Okay. And I mean, obviously, your site's Zobo with a Shotgun. And what was the sort of the inspiration, really, for setting out on this journey just to discover these weird and quite grotesque films that most people tend to avoid, or if they do watch them, it's sort of like that one film, and then they do like a big block of something a little more safe, should we say.
But I mean it's continuing now, maybe it's not so heavy now purely because of time issues and, you know, working a lot, etc. But there came to a point in my life where I was almost obsessed with searching for kind of the most disturbing, extreme, the nastiest thing that could be made in film that wasn't real. So what a lot of people don't actually know about me is I'm very, very squeamish when it comes to real life blood and things. I pass out at blood tests. If I cut myself, I will pass out, hands down. But when it comes to film, it doesn't affect me at all. And I watched a lot of horror films, and, you know, they had a lot of gore. There was, you know, you've kind of got like your torture porn. You've got, I mean, I rewatched Hostel recently, actually, and it's quite tame considering. But, you know, you've got those kinds of films that, you know, focus a lot on different kind of ways to kill someone, to torture someone. And then I just got obsessed with looking at these films that went so far that it was, you know, very realistic. The effects were so real that even though, you know, it's not real, it kind of blurs the line. And when I was at university, I also did my dissertation on kind of desensitization through watching horror films, you know, and I did a study of, I think I interviewed 200 people in the end, and it seemed that, you know, the more horror films you watched from a younger age, you were desensitized to seeing these types of violence. So through that, I kind of became very focused on how far can you push yourself to watch something that's so extreme with, you know, violence, sexual violence, that you wouldn't even have thought could exist. You know, you watch some of these films and they do things that you're like, wow, I watched many horror films and I didn't think that would even be a way to torture someone or a way to show a death. And I think it was that for me, kind of, it's more like a psychological thing, you know, what can you push yourself to watch? How far can you go before you say, I need to stop watching this shit? It's, you know, going to mess with my mind. And so far, I'm still on the journey. There's plenty of films I've got to watch. And yeah, I just find it fascinating that, you know, movie makers can really portray something that's so nasty and would be hidden in the corner of, you know, the sickest serial killer, yet we'll still watch it because there's something in the human psyche that kind of, you know, curiosity to watch something so nasty.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, obviously your aversion to real life gore and blood, and it's actually a trait shared by yourself and Stuart Gordon, the legendary horror filmmaker, who's actually well documented by his own wife of actually fainting on the set of Dolls when he decided he was going to have lunch with her and she was in full head crush makeup, and he had to go and step outside to have a quick breather because he got himself a little worked up over it. So, but I mean, Stephen, obviously for yourself, I mean, when it comes to the gore and violence, obviously Asian cinema has for a large extent been associated with these things thanks to the likes of Ishii the Killer. Where do you obviously stand in when it comes to like the gore and violence? I mean, do you prefer to see it in Asian horror, or do you prefer something a little more subtle?
Well, I think Zoe and I are coming from a different place, but that's okay. So I've always loved horror movies. I've always loved the cult and the strange, but actually what attracted me to Asian horror was probably actually some territories which weren't as graphic and gory. So whilst you have, you know, obviously there's the extreme cinema of Japan, and that's where I came in. Yeah, I came in with, like you say, Ichi the Killer, Audition, and things like that. And the Cat 3 stuff from Hong Kong. But actually what interests me more is and this is across the board, and horror is just part of this, is the cultural differences, you know, because, you know, Asia's a big place. And it interested me to see horror films that were far more interested in tension and atmosphere and build up. There's a lot more ghost stories and things like that, things that sort of chill me rather than in your face gore. It's there for sure, but my interest is more in how it is different to Western horror.
Yeah, I feel certainly when we compare it to Western horror, certainly when you look at Asian horror in general, there is always a reason for the ghost or the monster being there, whereas Western horror, it just tends to be, oh, it's just there, and there's normally some throwaway reason. But there's only when we look at the Asian horror films, especially things such as like Dark Water, Ring, there's always that deep-seated reason for the apparition, the focus of the film being there to begin with. And I think we have actually seen it with some of the later Asian horrors, that they've fallen into this trap that the Western horror has have, where everything needs to be over-explained. And certainly going back to Dark Water, we found it at the end of that film, the last 15 minutes could have been cut out because it basically explained what we'd already been told already.
Indeed. Yeah.
So,
well, it just obviously it's coming from a different place. So a lot of the Asian religions and, you know, are based a lot in animism and shamanism and things like that in the past, and Buddhism, of course. So, and they have a different relationship with subjects such as death than maybe we do in the West. So in the West, it's something to be feared, that the people who are dead are often feared, whereas in the East, you know, that there are festivals dedicated to the people who have long gone, So there's this sort of culture clash, which I find fascinating.
And I mean, do either of you have like directors you sort of tend to gravitate towards within Asian horror, or do you take it more on a tale-by-tale basis? I mean, for yourself, sorry, I mean, do you have a preference over how you seek out your Asian horror?
I mean, personally, a lot of the, you know, films I watch are recommendations. You know, I have a lot of people that know the kind of films that I like, and I go based a lot on recommendations. I mean, I always say this, but the first place I go to is the people that I follow on Twitter. I follow people that have very similar tastes to me, because I kind of, you know, it's like that word of mouth thing. So I will genuinely believe, sometimes they're wrong, of course, but most of the time, a lot of those people, you know, they're into the same thing. So I ask them. I'm not, like, honestly, I'm not someone that, because I always feel like directors, they tend to, you know, once you find a good one, they tend to do, you know, kind of similar things that tend to be on the same scale. They're very good. But oftentimes, I always feel like if I follow one, I'll become tired of what they do, because you can kind of see the same things within each of their works. And then I'm like, oh, you know, and everything blurs into one. So I try to find a lot of my films as well, just based off my own research. I mean, I love reading. And as a writer, I love reading other people's written recommendations, written reviews. So I like to do research and kind of go based on trying to find, you know, lots of different things rather than sticking to the one person. That's my personal thing. And I mean, I do that for all genres. I like to just kind of see what I like the look of. Because I also feel sometimes if you go based on, you know, like actors or directors, you might miss something that's really good because you've gone, oh, I'm going to watch this instead. Or as well, you know, there might be a director you love and then you watch one of their films and you don't particularly like that one. And then, you know, you skip over other ones because it's like, I wasn't sure what, you know, what they did in this. I mean, I know it's kind of for film, that is one of the things you kind of go based on previous works and stuff. But I do feel like a lot of directors, you know, they can have something that's amazing and then they can have something that's really shit. And then also at the same time, they often will tend to use the same kind of, you know, gimmicks in every single film. And then you end up tired of what they've done. So I personally, for me, it's recommendations, friend recommendations, and Twitter is a great place for that.
Same question, Stephen, for yourself.
I probably feel very similar to Zoe. I do have directors I love, but not necessarily that operate in the horror genre. Some of the films I've chosen tonight come from quite famous directors, but I wouldn't say that they are actually horror specific. There's a couple that I will go to. So there's a Thai pair, and tonight's going to be, instead of two white guys butcher Asian names, it's going to be two white guys and a white female butcher Asian names, isn't it? So I'm going to go for it. So they're by Banjong Pisanthakan and Park Poom Wong Poom, who made The Shutter and Alone and the Phobia films from Thailand. I do hunt out what they do. Other than that, though, you know, I'll obviously, you know, you and I are both on record about Takashi Miike and Sion Sono and people like that if they put out a horror film. But it's not because it's a horror film. Just because it's one of their films, you know.
I think you nailed it around the head there, Simon. The fact is that a lot of Asian horror sort of stumbled into because it's what's happened to be coming out at the time. I mean, certainly when we had the revival of interest in Asian cinema as a whole, it was the Asian horror films which were leading that charge. Because if you remember, as we've mentioned numerous times on the show, it was Ringu, Battle Royale, and Audition, and three films. And they inadvertently sparked this huge boom in J-horror especially. And I think because of the labels and the way they're releasing things, I think I've gone through sort of periods with different directors. So obviously starting off with like Takashi Miike, with like Audition and Dead or Alive, and later Ishii the Killer. Also had people like Shinsei Tsukamoto, who obviously gave us Tetsuo, Snake of June, and recently Tsukamoto has really become into vogue because Quentin Tarantino's apparently discovered him or just mentioned him in passing, so everyone's raving about his work. So it's kind of interesting to see him. And then obviously, as we've seen more of an interest in rising Korean cinema, people like Park Chan-wook, in particular like his Vengeance trilogy. And it's been interesting as we've obviously seen more titles coming across, especially seeing more of the extreme titles, just the wide range of genres that Asian horror tends to cover. It's not just so clearly defined as like Western horror, even though you can obviously like break it down to like the two categories. You can have like your traditional ghost stories, like the long-haired ghosts, or you can have like the more disjointed, non-linear, more ambitious stuff like MPD Psycho, Pulse, those sorts of movies. And like, again, just bringing back Tetsuo, which is only an hour, but it's probably one of the most random, most bizarre hours of filmmaking you will have the delight or horror of watching, depending on what viewpoint you're approaching it from. But no, I think there's always something new with Asian horror, which is something I haven't found with Western horror. Western horror seems to be very trend-driven. It's sort of like whatever's hot at the time, where Asian horror just always seems to be, well, this would be interesting to shoot. Why don't we go and have a look at this? So, I mean, have either of you sort of found your sort of like limit when you're watching these sort of films, that you've sort of like thought, oh, okay, I may have perhaps overstepped my line? Zoe, I don't think it's going to be so much the case for yourself, because I think you said you're still trying to find your line, but I mean, have you sort of hit that point where you think, oh, I may have gone a little too far this time?
I think the furthest I went, and I'm sure I've mentioned this film once or twice before, is, as you know, Tumbling Doll of Flesh. For me, that's kind of the furthest I've ventured, and I still think I can go further. It's a tough watch. I took a couple of breaks from it because I was like, wow, you know, do I need to reconsider my life and the things that I'm doing with my life when I'm watching stuff like this on my own in my bedroom? But yeah, that was kind of as far as it goes now, that was kind of my line. But I think the reason for that is because it also incorporates kind of the sexual aspect, which, I mean, it's heavily sexual violence in, you know, some ways that, like I was saying earlier, that I, you know, I would have never thought of. I never thought that you could, you know, have sex with a chopped off leg, the whole of it, whatever it is. That was not something that would have ever crossed my mind ever before I watched that film. However, because I can differentiate between the reality and the non-reality, I think I'm still willing to go, you know, further and find other things. I mean, this is not Asian cinema, but, you know, I've been reading 120 Days of Sodom, which has taken me, I'm maybe about three quarters through, but I've been reading that for over 2 years now. And that's just a book, that's not even a film. And that pushes a line for me where I'm sometimes very uncomfortable reading that book, so much so that I put it away for months on end. So, I mean, I think I would love to find a film that pushes me to that point where I go, I'm actually going to probably go and watch a Disney movie and continue on a Disney theme for the next 6 months because I need to cleanse myself. But yeah, in terms of film, it's definitely Tumbling Doll of Flesh. And if I mention to anyone that I've watched that, they're, you know, I just kind of have to give a very short synopsis and they're like, ah, okay, I see what you're watching now.
And Stephen, have you found your limit yet with Asian horror? Are you do you have like this advantage of obviously working within the field that you kind of have prior warning going into films what to expect?
I feel like I need a shower just reading the wiki page of Tumbling Doll of Flesh right now. I don't know. I don't know if I've found a limit. My problem is possibly is I don't get as scared as I used to, and I miss that. You sort of start watching things with a critical eye, and you. It's very rare that I feel lost or totally caught up in something for either the physical or the emotional or the psychological horror to really scare me. And which is what tonight is, I think some of the films I've picked, the reason I have is because they have scared me rather than repulsed me.
Cool. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be diving headfirst into our draft this evening. But until in the meantime, here's a quick word from one of our fellow podcasters.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
And we're back, still listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club. This, is, of course, is our Asian horror film draft. Of course, joining me as always is my co-host, Stephen Palmer.
Hello.
And we, of course, are still joined by our special guest this evening, Zoe Rose Smith from Zobo Red Shotgun.
Hello.
If you obviously want to get involved and leave us some feedback, let us know your favorite Asian horror, please do. We now have got the Twitter feed that is open, which is at AC Film Club. You can also drop us an email, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. As well, we now have our own iTunes and Podomatic feeds, so if you're on iTunes, look up Asian Cinema Film Club and hit that subscribe, you know, maybe leave us a review or a nice star rating. And on Podomatic as well, we also have our own dedicated feed on there, as where, you know, we're moving forward, we're making the show less of a secondary show, more of its own thing, because we feel that everyone's been really behind the show since we launched it, and you know, we wanted to make it a more of a dedicated show rather than just tacking it on the MBDS feed. So we're moving forward, we've got some exciting things coming up, and we always like to say thank you to everyone who's obviously supported the show so far, and hope you continue to do so in the coming episodes. But obviously, back to tonight's show, we are doing a draft of Asian horror. The order of our draftees this evening, we're going to, of course, go ladies first. So Zoe will be kicking us off. It will then go to Stephen and finally to myself, and we will go around the table until we've all named our five. So Zoe, what do you want to kick off with?
I'm going to kick off with, and according to the internet, which often lies, it's not a horror film, but I think most would disagree with that. So my first choice is Battle Royale.
Damn it.
I was more than certain that someone would have that.
Yeah, Battle Royale, absolutely astounding pick. It's one of those films that people who don't like subtitle movies love this movie, my brother being a prime example, and it's never been dubbed. It's always been a subtitled movie, yet people absolutely adore this movie.
It's just a great movie. I mean, oh my gosh, my fire alarm is going off. Give me one second.
No worries.
I apologize about that. Yeah, it's all kicking off here. Yeah, so as I was saying, Battle Royale is just an amazing movie. The first time I ever watched it was with my dad, who is the person that got me into horror films. And at that point, when I first watched it, I hadn't really watched that many Asian horror films, except for kind of supernatural ones. And I watched this and I was like, Wow. I think I was at school at the time as well, which made it even better because I was like, I wish this would happen at my school. And yeah, it's just an amazing film. I wrote a piece many, many, many years ago, maybe 6 years ago, about how I thought the Hunger Games had totally tried to rip off Battle Royale, and that someone out there had, you know, watched Battle Royale, seen how well it had done. Like you said, it's never been dubbed or anything, so they went ahead and made a unconnected American remake in a sense. But Battle Royale is great. I would urge anyone that hasn't seen it to go and watch it because it's super fun, very fun.
Yeah, great opening pick there. Suzanne Collins, who wrote The Hunger Games, actually went on record to claim that she had never heard nor seen a Battle Royale. That's right, she's never heard of the most popular, well-known Asian horror movie of all time. But Stephen, I mean, do I even have to ask if you're a fan of Battle Royale?
Well, I'm not just a fan of Battle Royale, the movie, but the novel it is based on is well worth hunting down as well. It's actually better than the film. So some of the sort of background of the kids is explored a little more, and the world's created a little more. But yes, of course, it's a bloody horror film. It's kids killing kids in occasionally grotesque ways. And again, the novel has got, I think Zoe would like it actually. There's some there's some hardcore stuff there. And I think it's something that maybe I think you and I were sort of debating earlier this week was what constitutes a horror film. And I think anything that unsettles you really, and therefore Battle Royale was one of my also rans. So I think we all picked in some way, shape, or form, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean Kinji Fukasaku. He's an absolutely fantastic director, even outside this film, even though I think for a lot of people this was his most well-known film. He did the Japanese sections for Tora Tora Tora. He also did the Battles Without Honor and Humanity saga, which, if you didn't pick it up from Arrow, they will now happily charge you an absolute fortune to go and pick it up now. And people say that the Battle Royale 2 isn't as good, and they often try to compare this the two films, but I think Battle Royale 2, even though he didn't finish it was actually finished by his son, that it's still a worthy sequel as well, even though Battle Royale, whether you're reading it as a book or the manga or just watching the fantastic film version, it's fantastic whatever way you watch it. So yeah, sorry, fantastic pick for your opening there. Over to Stephen, how do you want to open your draft?
Okay, I feel I'm going for a bit of an obvious choice as well, but maybe not. So I'm going to pick Kim Ji-woon's A Tale of Two Sisters, which is a Korean, let's see, Wikipedia calls it a psychological horror thriller drama, which seems to be hedging its bets a bit. But it's one of the most beautiful looking horror films you'll ever see. It's actually based on an ancient Korean fairy tale and had been filmed many times before. But as Kim Ji-woon tends to do, he sort of takes tropes and styles and genres of cinema and puts his own little blend on it. It's brilliantly acted. It looks brilliant. It's disturbing rather than scary. It's got two fantastic central performances by Im Soo Young and Moon Gyun Young, and it's also one of those sort of early Tartan releases, and so it's sort of one of my early entries into the genre, but and showed me how beautiful a scary film could be.
Yeah, Tale of Two Sisters, totally agree with yourself. It kind of opened the door for Korean cinema as a whole, and obviously led to many fantastic directors coming across on the backs of Tarlan, obviously choosing to back Korean cinema, and certainly choosing this as one of their opening picks. I mean, so have you seen Tale of Two Sisters?
Yes, I have. It was when I went on a HMV splurge at one point, never heard of it, and bought A Tale of Two Sisters, and I watched it and completely agree with you, Stephen. It's beautiful. I mean, like you said, it's often hard to think that a horror film would be beautiful, but this film really is. And I think the the story as well, it kind of has an element of everything. You know, it is horror, but it also has it's very sad in many ways as well. And like you said, it's, you know, it's a ghost story. It kind of encompasses everything that, you know, great Asian cinema does when it comes to horror and kind of ghost stories. So yeah, I love this film. I think there's also actually, I think I also saw that they did an American remake of it.
Avoid.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not gonna watch that. Yeah.
It's called The Uninvited and it's dreadful.
Yes.
Well, for my opening pick, I'm going to go with the animated psychological thriller from Satoshi Kon, which is Perfect Blue. Perfect Blue, if you're not familiar with it, is probably one of the top five essential animes of all time. I would rank it up there with the likes of Akira and Ghost in the Shell. Not only is one of my favorites, but just an absolute must-see. I mean, Satoshi Kon, as a director, I feel that he is yet to make... he was yet to make any film that I didn't particularly like or have some sort of reaction to it. I mean, it's only the sadder the fact he died at 46 from cancer, making it all the more sadder whenever you watch one of his films to know that it's just another one off the list, that there is going to be no more films. And you can see when you look at the likes of Perfect Blue, or his series Paranoid Agent, which is very reminiscent of Twin Peaks, or if you perhaps look at something like Paprika, which served as a key inspiration for Inception. His work has clearly proven this big inspiration. You can see it in various forms. And I think when people talk about anime and they say, oh, it's just like violence and big boob schoolgirls and fan service, I say watch Perfect Blue and it would completely change the way you look at anime and the way that stories are certainly told within the animated style. So yeah, Perfect Blue would be my opening pick.
Well, I got to agree with you. You know, I'm not a huge anime fan, as we've talked about many times, but Perfect Blue, absolutely. It's one of the sort of four pillars of anime for me. Again, psychological thriller, horror, and also one of the few films that I actually think would justify a live action remake, because I think its story of stardom and stalkers and so on is just as valid today as it was when it was made. It must be about 20 years ago now.
Yeah, because, I mean, this was 97, so, yeah, 20 years. So, Zoe, do you say you haven't seen this one yet?
No, I haven't. I've never had a good relationship with anime, but it's not just anime, it's kind of cartoon things in general. I have a hard time watching kind of animated things in general, but based on your recommendation, I'll definitely give it a watch. Maybe it will make me change my mind.
I'll be interested to see what you make of it. I think you'd like it because it's certainly got its shocking moments in it. There's a scene in it where this ex-J-pop star, who we obviously follow Mima, she's decided she's going to quit being a J-pop star and go into acting. And she gets a role in this erotic thriller called Double Bind, and she plays a rape victim in a strip club scene. And it's a scene I discussed with Helen McCarthy, who wrote the encyclopedia of anime. And I'm thinking, I'm talking to this really nice lady in this really nice knitted jumper, and we're here talking about what tentacles represent in demon anime, so things like Legend of the Overfiend, and in particular she wanted to talk about this scene. So it was a very surreal afternoon, but it certainly sort of instilled in my mind just how good this film actually is, perhaps more than I realized, and it's certainly only grown better the more I've gone back to it. So yeah, that's my opening pick, Perfect Blue. Back to Zoe, what are you going to go for pick two?
Okay, for my second pick, I think I'm going to go for Men Behind the Sun.
Oh, God.
Another one of the weird ones, one of the more extreme ones. So I actually, I would like to rewatch this because I watched this, I think I was speaking to you the other day about dubbed movies, and I watched this dubbed, and has anyone seen The Mighty Boosh?
Yeah.
So, you know, what's he called? The guy, when they're at the zoo, he has the eagle and the big moustache. I think.
Right.
So anyway, it's dubbed, and the main guy's voice sounds exactly similar to that guy's voice, which was a very, very, very strange experience. And me and my friends, we thought it was, I mean, it made it quite hilarious considering what we were watching. But anyway, back to the movie, that's kind of unrelated. Yeah, so Men Behind the Sun, I did a bit of research, and this again came up on my list of one of the, you know, kind of extreme disturbing ones. And I didn't think it would be that bad. And obviously it's based on kind of war atrocities and, you know, historical elements. And I watched it and it is pretty horrific. I mean, I love it. I think it's great. Obviously I wouldn't, it's not a film I would suggest to everyone to watch. I think it's probably more of a niche kind of taking, but again, it kind of, it showcases that extreme element that I really like. And one of the scenes in it that I found actually the most horrific was the scene with the cat, where if you've seen it, there's a cat and there's lots of rats, and the rats are kind of eating the cat alive. I think me and my friends thought that was, you know, that was quite a traumatizing moment. And we were all like, we're cat lovers. So we're watching that and we're like, oh my God, is this, you know, is it like Cannibal Holocaust? Is it real, etc.? And I did some research and it turns out that apparently they just covered the cat in honey and the rats licked the honey off him. And that's why it looks like they're eating him. But yeah, I think this film really shows what can be done. I mean, it came out in 1988. The effects for that time, special effects are great. They are, you know, they are very horrific. And I think that shows kind of, you know, like almost a labor of love at that time to go as far to show something so extreme and use effects that for that time were amazing. So yeah, for me, I choose Men Behind the Sun.
Yes, a round of family viewing there from Zoe. Stephen, do I even ask if you've seen Men Behind the Sun?
I haven't seen it, but I have heard of it actually. So fun fact time. This was the film that created Cat 3 ratings in Hong Kong. So, because even though it's about Japanese atrocities, it's actually a Chinese film, which you probably won't know from the dubbing, I imagine. But it sounds hideous. But then the actual historical events it was based on are pretty hideous. So, yeah, I don't think I'll be watching it, Zoe. Sorry.
That's okay. I understand.
Stephen, where do you want to go next?
Where does one go? No. Okay. So I'm going to now get... this is another film which we could suggest isn't necessarily horror, but it's by a director that you mentioned earlier, Elwood. This is Kotoko by Shinya Tsukamoto, who, like you say, was... Is the guy behind the Tetsuo films and Snake of June and things like that. And this is a 2011 film starring Coco, who was a sort of a really quite popular Japanese pop folk sort of star, i.e. she sings with a guitar rather than 1,000 beats per minute music with helium. But it's the story of a young Japanese single mother who suffers from we don't really get told what it is, but it's basically schizophrenia. And in Tsukamoto manages, and he draws upon actually Coco's own life, as she suffers from mental illness. and depression and such like. And he just creates this audio and visual world which generates a feeling of empathy that you feel you know what it's like. For example, when she sees people, she also sees like an evil twin of them, and as if they've got sort of violent intentions towards her. And it's just done so brilliantly with handheld digital camera work and this atonal score which appears, and the director himself actually appears later on as a sort of a stalker that strikes up a relationship with her that lets her beat him up, beat him to a bloody pulp just so he can have a relationship with her. It's probably more sort of an indie psychological thriller. It's in the same vein as, say, Polanski's Repulsion or the Bjork film, what was it, Dancer in the Dark, yeah. That kind of thing. But I watched it again last night just to make sure it was for this podcast, really. And it absolutely is. It's one of those films that really made me feel. And sometimes the scariest things are things that are going on in your own head, yeah, rather than ghosts and witches and zombies and mad scientists and things like that. It's the self and the failure of understanding your surroundings and making sense of the world, which could be pretty darn scary.
Cool. Anyone else want to comment on that one at all? Or?
No, I haven't seen that one, but it sounds really, really interesting. It sounds kind of similar to like a Asian version of The Babadook.
Yes. But well, no, not so better, but it's much more grounded in reality, although it isn't. But it's available on a UK DVD, so it and Blu-ray as well, I think, from Third Window. So it's something that is accessible by people quite easily without having to hunt the depths of the internet.
Awesome. Right, for my next choice, I'm going to go for another obvious one, I think. But if I didn't pick it, I would sort of kick myself, and that is Takashi Miike's Audition. Audition, I think, is like Battle Royale, it's become one of these Asian horror films which is well known even to people who would normally classify themselves as being fans of Asian horror. The downside, of course, has been that the real kicker behind Audition has been given away and has now become the most well-known aspect of the film. As such, I think this is Miike, who's when he releases this film at in 1999, is really working at the height of his powers as a director, especially for his outlaw period. And here he crafts a film which is quite different than a lot of the other films he's making in this particular period, so like Dead or Alive, Rainy Dog, Shinjuku Triad Society. And we have this, obviously, this widowed producer who organizes a fake audition to try and find himself a partner. And obviously, his said partner turns out to be an absolute psychotic, as I think we all know already from just the reputation this film has. But, I mean, if you can see Audition blind, then all the better. The least you know about Audition going in, the better, as this is a film which, if you just saw like the vague trailer that Tarden put out when they released this film, then I would say that that's is the sort of noise you want to have with this film, Grenin, because it's a film which really pays off. It's very slow burning, but the actual payoff at the end is just absolutely fantastic. And this slow descent into horror and even just like the slight tinges of madness as we get into like the third act just make this such a standout film, not only for Asian horror but for Takashi Miike as well. But I mean, guys, what do you obviously make of Audition? Are you fans?
Yes, definitely. I like you said, I went into this film very blind. I'd seen it, like I said, through research and found it, but I decided I didn't want to know too much about it. Picked up a copy in HMV, and as you mentioned, it's very slow burning. And at first, I was like, not sure this is. I was like, okay, when's it going to get to anything? And then I remember one of the scenes with the bag and whatever is in the bag. And at that point, that's when I realized that I, like you said, there was going to be a good payoff. And I always remember that scene. It was just being so disturbing. I mean, it's so surreal and dreamlike. And so it kind of made me feel a bit sick. It's just really, really weird, just weird and disturbing. But yeah, Audition is a great film. And like you said, definitely worth the payoff.
Stephen?
Well, obviously, we've spoken about this for an hour before on an MDBS podcast, so you can all go over and find that on the feed somewhere. But yeah, I mean, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Murakami's original novel as well, which is actually what I think is most impressive. I think this is Mikey's most controlled, measured, and most film-like film. It's a slow burn. Takes a long way to go. It's funny, the moment that Zoe talked about, of course, is in the blooming trailer and ruins everything. it will stay with you. You will remember this. This is the film that I give to people to say this is the sort of film I watch, and just to get the response back from them later. So yeah, it's easy pick.
And normally people who've seen it all want to say those very key words, don't they?
Ticka, 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 ticka.
There we go. Zoe, what would you like for your third pick?
So for my third pick, I had maybe like five different options. I really wanted to pick Pulse. But I spoke about that for a very long time on another podcast recently. So I decided I wouldn't, because I literally picked this film for basically everything because I love it so much. But I wanted to go for something else. And the other choice was going to be Ju-on, of course, because of what I said earlier. But again, I've spoken about it many, many times, so I left that out. So I actually, my next choice is Dumplings from Three Extremes, because, well, as you can guess, it's from Three Extremes. It's extreme. My favourite, of course. And I love it because, again, it goes back to the pushing boundaries. And I think the concept of Dumplings, which is about an older woman, she performs kind of backstreet coat hanger abortions, if you will. And she makes dumplings from these abortions, which apparently keep you young, which sounds great, not the greatest way to go about it. I think the entire concept of it is horrific. In the day, I work for a baby clothing company, so I can't mention that I would ever watch anything like this, because it just becomes an issue, and I would probably be worried that I would lose my job. I'm sure I would. But yeah, I think it's quite short for a film, and I watched it with my friend, and I didn't tell him anything about this movie whatsoever, and we started watching it, and he was just like, "Wow, what the fuck is this?" But yeah, I think it goes back to that aspect that it kind of pushes a boundary that I think a lot of other filmmakers, a lot of other, you know, kind of countries are, I mean, maybe not so much anymore, but maybe at this time, are kind of afraid to do. It's broaching an issue, which is, I mean, abortion is an issue that's kind of, you know, debated across the world, whether it's right, whether it's wrong. You know, we won't get into personal things, but it's quite a controversial topic, to say the least. And then to make a film that's not only about abortion, but it's about doing that, and then making dumplings, which is obviously a great delicacy when it's not made from dead children, into a film, is it pushes that boundary out there. But that's why I love it. I think cinema was made to push personal boundaries and to kind of showcase these boundaries that maybe you shouldn't go there, but why the hell not? That's what filmmaking's about.
Yeah, Fruit Chan's Dumplings. It's a film which, again, myself and Steven, we've obviously discussed, and I think one of the things we talked about in particular in that episode that we talked about it was the sound design being one of the most disturbing elements of this film.
Yes.
Yeah, hearing Miriam Young crunch down on those dumplings is and especially one, and they let the secrets out of the bag quite early on, isn't it? And yeah. It's just yeah. Horrible. Have you seen the longer version? They made a theatrical length version of it as well. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I watched it
as part of Three Extremes. So there's one it's about twice as long, and the ending's a little different, and there's more subplot with her husband. That's equally worth checking out. I think we decided they both sort of stood alongside each other, didn't we, Elwood?
Yeah, I mean, both cuts are as good as each other. It's not the case of, and it's not even like the case of like the longer versions, like the director's cut, if you want. They both have their own way, and I think they both stand on their own. You can even have like the short version in Three Extremes, which is a really fun, grotesque little self-contained tale, or you can have the longer version, which obviously expands on certain characters and gives us a different ending as well, I believe.
It's slightly different, yeah.
Which makes it worthwhile, but no, Dumplings is one of those unusual films in the fact that you can recommend both versions, and neither version's inferior to the other. So... yeah, whether you watch it, it's Three Extremes, which obviously has the advantage of the fact you get the short films by Park Chan-wook and Takashi Miike as well, or you're watching it as its own film, I don't think you can go wrong with either version, certainly.
No, totally agree.
Yeah. So I would never put you down as selling baby clothes.
No, most people don't, but yeah, spend my daytimes, you know, talking to mums about babies and cute stuff.
It's like, oh, you like babies? You should really watch Dumplings.
Yeah, slip them a copy of Men Behind the Sun. Yeah.
Okay. Stephen, where do you want to go next?
Well, I'm going to go. So I just want to say Pulse is one of my favourite films of all time. And I didn't pick it either, so that it's lost two chances from the sounds of it to get on here.
Why have you done this?
I know. That's for any other business, but yeah, absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to go for a film called Dream Home by director Pang Ho Chung, who is one of my favorite Hong Kong directors. This is quite a departure for him. So if you just dribble back a bit in history, like we said, the Cat 3 thing in Hong Kong, where cinema actually in China across the board is still in mainland China, there is no rating system, but Hong Kong, because of certain films, one of which we've already talked about, set up a rating system, and that's what's known as Category 3, and that set off a whole bunch of extreme films, like the Ebola Syndrome, and even the Shaw brothers ended up in Cat 3 land before they ended. When Hong Kong got handed back over, it was quite sad for Hong Kong cinema, because all that extremeness, that not just in horror but in all sorts of cinema, has been washed away, and Hong Kong cinema especially is quite muted these days. So actress Josie Ho formed a film company, 852 Films, alongside some other people like Juno Mack, and in order to kind of recreate that golden age of Hong Kong cinema. It hasn't been an entirely successful experiment, but the first film they put out was a film called Dream Home, and Dream Home is the best Asian slasher film there is, period. I won't have an argument about it. It's about a young girl who is desperate to move into a dream home, saving up all her money. Unfortunately, she gets involved in a chain. She can't, and they turn her down, but she's so desperate to have this house, she embarks on a rampage of murder and death just to get this house. So it's a great horror film. It includes a cock chopping, if that appeals to anybody. That's the level of gore we're talking about. But it also has a really serious social message about how hard it is to get a house in Hong Kong and the housing crisis that they have. Because it's Pang Ho Chung, it's fairly witty, it's fairly satirical, but it's proper gory. It was the first thing I thought of when we started on this list.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, Dream Home actually made it on our list. Over on our Facebook and Twitter feed, we are having a 31... Yes, we're having a 31 film countdown to Halloween. Dream Home actually came in on day 4. Sandwiched right between Bloody Muscle Bodybuilder in Hell, while on the other side we had Our Point. So, Dream Home is not to be confused with the Daniel Craig movie of the same name. Obviously, Dream Home is, it's certainly a unique film, and certainly in the fact that it's an Asian slasher. I would say I don't tend to see too many come across, but great pick. For myself, I'm going back and forth over my options at the minute. I'm going to go pick another director that I'm absolutely obsessed with, and that is Sion Sono with the film Cold Fish. Cold Fish is a film which I think I stumbled into a lot like Sion Sono. I mean, cause it was one of his first films that I saw without realizing it was a Sion Sono movie, the same as Love Exposure, Suicide Club, and it's basically this film where this mild-mannered guy who works in a fish shop is finding himself under pressure from his more upscale rival who basically run the shop. Like, if Hooters decided to get out of the bar game and get into the fish-selling industry, they would make a fish shop like the one we see him working in here. And it's really the story of this guy, and he's sort of drawn into this darker world of body disposal as he gets caught up in this string of ongoing murders that are being carried out by this rival tropical fish salesman and his wife. It's a film that is bloody, but yet at the same time very justified in its violence. And I just found this film absolutely fascinating. And I think if anything was responsible for my session with Sono's films, I would say it with this film, even though obviously Sono's now gone on to be more known for the likes of Tokyo Tribe and Why Don't You Play in Hell. This still remains like one of those points where his films like really started getting really interesting and started just being more than just another Asian horror director. Between this and Love Exposure, I would say, is really when he started getting really interesting as a director, and something that he's only seems to have continued with the films which have followed, as he's kind of picked up the mantle from Takashi Miike in sort of like continuing that outlaw period style that Miike used to obviously be more familiar with before he obviously went on to do sort of more highbrow sort of cinema that he's doing now. Cold Fish, anyone got any thoughts on that one, or your fans?
It's on my radar, but I haven't watched it yet. I've heard it's very good.
It's not my favourite Sion Sono. I would have gone with Suicide Circle probably as the horror pick, but it's from a very strong period of work. Like you say, it's part of like the trilogy with Love Exposure and Guilty of Romance, two films which I love, and I always think it's the weakest of the three. But you know, it's a bit like saying, you know, it's the weakest of brilliance. So it's still a fantastic pick.
Cool. Zoe, where would you like to go next?
Okay, so going slightly newer, something that I watched not that long ago, actually. That I really, really, really enjoyed was The Wailing. I heard lots of people talking about it. Again, it says on the internet that it's not a horror film, but I think it is. As you said earlier, Stephen, if something disturbs you, then it's a horror film. So we're going to include it. So it's from Na Hong Jin. I can't pronounce anything.
Welcome to the club.
And yeah, I mean, the storyline is kind of hard to wrap up, but basically there's a series of brutal murders in a village, and one guy is suspected of doing it. He kind of came to the village not that long ago, and it follows the police detective as he kind of tries to catch the supposed killer of these brutal murders, which, you know, as time goes on, it kind of involves his daughter, who you see he's very close with. What I really enjoyed about the film was kind of the overall atmosphere of it. So this is obviously not one that's on the extreme scale, but how you said earlier, Stephen, how there a lot of Asian films often focus on kind of, you know, the feeling of it being very tense. I found this film, so the runtime is, it's very long. I can't remember how, 156 minutes is the runtime. So it's a long, long film. I watched it on a train journey, but the entire film kept me on edge. I felt very tense. I felt the atmosphere. It has, there's lots of different elements to it. And I think in a way it is kind of a slow burner because it runs for such a long time. Some of it's kind of slow, and it seems almost as nothing is really happening. But I think when you look at it on an overall whole, although nothing is really happening, lots of things are happening. And, you know, for the protagonist, he's, you know, it starts at the beginning of the film and you kind of see his bond with his daughter is very close, and it builds up that kind of whole emotional state between him and his daughter and their loving relationship. And then it goes through, you know, this is, although it's his work, it's suddenly becoming part of his home life, and there's this brutal murders and there's this creepy guy involved supposedly, and a lot of people kind of, you know, there's hearsay, there's rumors, there's kind of, you know, how you said earlier about how in the kind of Asian genre, lots of you know, it's ghost stories, which is a lot about their culture. This plays into it. You know, they believe in, they have a shaman there who tries to rid, you know, the guy of the devil that's supposedly in him committing the murders, etc. But I think generally what I loved the most was how tense it was. The whole time I just felt on edge, and I really enjoyed it for, as I said, for the runtime. Usually after that amount of time, you're kind of like, yeah, come on, it's getting tiresome. But there wasn't a moment when I was tired of it. The entire film I felt was very tense and kept the atmosphere the whole way through.
That was my next pick. I am now hunting down to choose for my reserve list because I couldn't agree more. It was Eastern Kick's film of the year last year, so all the contributors had a vote, and it wasn't what I voted for, but it was in my top three. Everything Zoe says in spades. It starts off as like a police procedural and then explores all sorts of different areas. It's unsettling. It is scary. It also looks at things like Koreans' inherent racism to Japanese people. It looks at shamanism. It looks at fake Korean religion. It's a long film, but God, I don't like anything longer than 90 minutes, and I stuck with it the whole way, and I was seriously affected by it. Korean horror has had some very popular films. I've spoken about one, and I'm sure, you know, over the next few years Elwood will speak about many, many more, but it had hit a bit of a rut, and this film has reinvented Korean horror for me because it has shown that it can be looked at with a completely different eye in a completely different way, and it just escapes all the normal tropes of Korean horror. It's a brilliant film.
Yeah, a film, I think, along with Train to Busan, this has been one that's really been in vogue recently, certainly in the horror community. And, of course, I haven't seen it. So I will eventually get around to correcting that. Much like seeing Train to Busan, which I've also not seen, so shame on me twice. You mentioned already about the genre hopping, and I find this is something that is very... that Asian cinema is more willing to do than Western cinema. Certainly when you look at, like, another example being, like, Save the Green Planet, which starts off as kind of a light-hearted comedy and then goes into quite a dark psychological thriller. I find that more often than not, the Asian horror is more willing to jump around with genres in the same film than a Western, which would sort of define itself within those opening minutes, what sort of film it's going to be, and then sort of stick for it. But, no, now I've had two people battling over the whaling, I think it's time to boost it up the watch list, certainly.
I mean, Korean cinema is especially fond of genre hopping, not just in horror, but in all sorts of films. A film can start off as one as a police thriller and end up as a girl with cancer story, and you think, how did I get there? And it happens all over Asia, but Korean cinema is particularly enjoys messing with you like that.
Cool. Stephen, where did you want to obviously go now that Zoe sunk your battleship?
Yeah, I know. Well, it was going to happen, although I thought you were going to do it to me, not Zoe. But, okay, it's fine, because I had about 150 films to choose from. So I'm going to go for one of the Whispering Corridor films, but not the one people think I will go for. So the Whispering Corridor series are a bunch of Korean films that the only connection really is, I think they're all produced by the same people, and they're all about schoolgirls in all girls schools, and they all kind of vary in their story. The first film is a pretty straightforward ghost horror in a school. The second film's a bit more artsy. The third and fifth films do something else, but the voice, I think, is fairly unique. So it's Whispering Corridors for the voice. I like it because it's basically the story of a girl who gets killed and is a ghost, but it's not one of those ones where you find out she's a ghost in the final act. We know straight away, and she as a ghost is trying to find out who killed her, and we find out the story of her life around that. It's got a sharp look to it rather than some sort of the dreamy stuff going on. It eschews a lot of all the lesbian subtext of the other things. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it just makes it a little bit unique. And it stars Kim Ok-bin, who is one of the top modern Korean actresses. And she'll currently be, so I think probably the other role people will know her from is in Thirst, Park's sort of vampire film, sort of. But she's the star in The Villainess, which is sort of doing great guns at the moment. But yeah, The Voice, Whispering Corridors 4.
Again, Whispering Corridors, another series I need to get into. So thank you, Stephen, for obviously providing me a starting point there. I mean, is it best to watch them in order, or can you just watch them in any sort of order?
There's no continuing story. They just sort of happen to have similar environs that they take place in. But they are very different films. I think 3 and 5 feel pretty sort of standard, and they'd probably be a good starting point. 4 is a bit of an outlier. One is good because it's the first, and the second one is interesting, but it's a bit more of an investment of time. It's a bit more psychological than horror, a bit more artsy fartsy, but I like that.
Cool. Zoe, have you seen it, or is it one for your list as well?
I've heard of the, I think it's, is it the second one, the Memento?
Memento Mori, yeah.
Purely because my, the company, the baby company I work for are called Mori. So I've heard of Memento Mori because when I search for Mori on the internet for work, it brings that up. So that's the only reason why. But no, I was reading about it the other day, as happens be. So yeah, I'll definitely give it. I mean, I like the cover. The cover looks pretty cool. So yeah, it will go on the radar.
Good.
Right, for myself, I'm going to go for another anime. This time is from 2000, and it is Blood the Last Vampire. Blood the Last Vampire was put out by Production IG, who also did anime sequences for the likes of Kill Bill, as well as Linkin Park. The story itself, it features this young girl called Seiya, who basically also has a sideline as a vampire hunter. Now, the film is set in 1966, and the whole story takes place on the Yokoto Air Base, and it's surrounding it. You've got the build-up to the Vietnam War that's sort of running in the background. And she's basically been sent to this school, opposed to the schoolgirl, to hunt down these vampire-like creatures that are lurking within the school, and they have the ability to take on human form. So her method of disposal is, of course, a samurai sword. The film itself only runs for 45 minutes, so it's a real quick watch. And to its detriment, it does feel that it's all over and done with rather quickly. And it was kind of frustrating, the fact that we basically had to wait for like years after till we actually got a spin-off series with Blood Plus, as well as its a second series called Blood Sea. And they ran for about 50 episodes, and that was released in 2009. So a bit of a wait between the series and the film. But the actual animation in this film is absolutely stunning, as we go from the sort of traditional hand-drawn sort of style that Production IG have become associated with. And we have other shots such as blood splattering across a hospital curtain that looks so realistic. You would think that it's sort of live-action footage that's been inserted into this film. But it's a film that sort of hits the ground running with her hunting down a supposed vampire on a subway train, and sort of doesn't let up until the end credits. Now, there is a live action version as well, which some people like myself really like and other people absolutely hate. But I would definitely say we check out the anime. At 45 minutes, it's hardly going to take up a huge amount of your time. And it's certainly a nice, light anime to get into that obviously avoids the usual sort of pitfalls that tend to be associated with anime, as we've covered already. But I mean, for yourselves, have anyone else seen this one? Because I know you're both not the biggest anime fans here. So
I've seen the Hollywood live action with Jun Ji Hyun. That wouldn't make me a lover of it. No, actually, I've seen it actually. Yeah, it's a fun. It's a fun anime with some nice visuals and a sort of, you know, what's better than schoolgirls killing vampires, right?
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, I mean, your final pick of the evening, where would you like to go?
Well, it can't be something normal, really, can it? You mentioned this title earlier, Stephen. And I didn't say anything then because I thought I would leave it till now. But my top pick is Ebola Syndrome, which I don't feel like it should come as too much of a surprise by now. I love this movie. I think it's absolutely hilarious, and I don't think it's meant to be. But there are some scenes, particularly at the end, that I cried with laughter at. So I decided that I would watch Ebola Syndrome when there was the whole, you know, kind of thing when Ebola was actually an issue. And that's actually how I stumbled across it, because I was in the process of, one, researching movies, two, I was looking up the Ebola, and by happen of chance, I kind of came across this film, and I was like, you know what? What kind of better time to watch it than now? As messed up as that may be, but I was like, you know. So it's from Herman Yao, who you probably know for The Untold Story, another very messed up film. And it features Anthony Wong, who has also been in many, many Asian horror films, is known for kind of Cat 3, etc. And Ebola syndrome is about, as they like to call it, a serial rapist. And he goes to Africa and he rapes someone and he contracts Ebola. He goes back to Hong Kong, where he lives with his wife and his daughter. He runs I'm not sure if he runs it or he works there. Anyway, he is at the restaurant and he starts infecting people with Ebola and then feeding them in the form of burgers to other people, so that basically a kind of Ebola infection starts in their town. For me, like I said, much of it I found hilarious. I thought it was, it's very over the top. I mean, it's extremely over the top for both its sexual violence, its general violence. I mean, cannibalism, it's disgusting. There's lots of bodily fluids. I mean, Anthony Wong's character he made me feel sick the entire way through. He's disgusting. I mean, you know, as you would expect from a rapist, but I think the whole fact that he's kind of diseased and wants to spread this disease amongst everyone by raping people and then killing them and then feeding them to other people, I think actually it was, although I watched Tumbling Doll of Flesh, this was probably one of the other films that for me disturbed me the most. I think for quite a while I avoided eating burgers. I just couldn't get the thought out of my head of like diseases and people and all these nasty, nasty things going on. And I think as well, one of the other things that disturbs me the most about this film is the fact that, you know, he does this. He rapes women in the day and then he chops them up and he feeds them to his customers. They say the food is amazing. You know, the restaurant starts pulling in lots of customers. And then he goes home to his wife and child as if nothing ever happened. It really actually kind of, those scenes really played on my mind a lot. I found them very, 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 very disturbing. And then when I got to the end, I mean, the parts that made me laugh, he's kind of running around, just spitting at people, trying to infect them with Ebola. And it's so ridiculous, over the top, that it did make me laugh. I just kind of, you know, I imagined this happening in real life. And I was like, it's just chaos. It's absolute chaos. But yeah, so that's my last pick, Ebola Syndrome.
Yeah, choosing a suitably classy note to go out on there, Zoe, so thank you for that one.
Well, I love the Ebola syndrome, right? That'll be a shock for you. I think that's the kind of, because it's so over the top.
Yeah.
So sometimes these sort of, not so much from Hong Kong, but sort of the Japanese ones, I find are a bit po-faced and a bit overly serious. And that turns me off. But this is just a laugh. And what's even better, and this just sort of sums up Hong Kong cinema to me, I mean, Anthony Wong has gone from that and The Untold Story and things like that. He's actually a half caste. He's half English, half Hong Kong, half Chinese. And he's risen to become an absolute giant of cinema, not just in Hong Kong cinema, but actually he's been in some Western films as well. And I have a rule that if you add Anthony Wong to anything, you make it instantly better, however shit it is. So the way his career has gone from this, if you put this in a Western context and somebody made films like that, they wouldn't go on to win Oscars. Well, no. Anthony Wong has done the equivalent. And even more than that, Herman Yao, you've mentioned two of his early films, is now one of the best directors in currently working in Hong Kong. He's risen above and beyond. He makes all sorts of films, and he makes them on a budget, and he makes really solid films across all sorts of genres. And this is just one of the things I love about Hong Kong cinema, I guess, is that it's got this melting pot of weirdness, and out of it people can rise and become mainstream as well. So, you know, I don't expect you'll find many Western people. You find the actresses, don't you, the Hollywood actresses that did one horror film back in the day or something like that. But these, you know, this is filthy film.
No, you're completely right. Like, you know, in Western cinema, if you did something on this scale, it would kind of almost stays with you and is like a, you know, like a black mark on your CV kind of thing. But yeah, when it
would
comes
stay
to
in this, you would stay in that exploitation cinema, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd never move from it. Whereas, like you said, with them, they've, you know, it's fine that they did that, and now they're, you know, moving to mainstream bigger things, and everyone's like, yeah, that's absolutely fine, no worries.
I want to disagree slightly, and I want to say a Western director who starts off in splatter and is now highly regarded as a very profitable mainstream. I think Zoe's got it already.
Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi would be another good one. I didn't have him. Peter Jackson.
Yeah, that's very true.
Peter Jackson did his trilogy of splatter. He did Bad Taste. He did Meet the Feebles. And he did the absolutely divine Brain Dead, or Dead Alive if you're in the States. He then obviously goes off. He does Heavenly Creatures. He does The Frighteners. Then makes a little scene trilogy of Lord of the Rings. And does his fanboy version of King Kong, which I really like. And now I think everyone forgets, you know, he was the once his like golden boy splatter. And I mean, he's really proud of those films. He keeps saying that he's going to re-release them. He's got all this footage and back behind the scenes material he wants to release with them, but he just keeps getting drawn onto these big projects and never getting time to do it. So
I will say, though, I agree with you. And Sam Raimi's another example of someone who's maybe managed to rise up. Jackson's less Oscar-worthy work was done in New Zealand rather than in the Hollywood system. But it's still fairly rare. Whereas you go and have a look at Anthony Wong's Raped by an Angel 4 and things like that he's in, and then put it back to some other stuff that he's in. It's a far more common story in certainly in Hong Kong cinema. It might not be quite true around the rest of Asia.
I'm always surprised when Anthony Wong shows up as a good guy in anything. I mean, when Infernal Affairs comes out and he's like the undercover agent's like obviously he's reporting to us, like, what's Anthony Wong doing playing a good guy? He's like, you know, the sleazy bad guy. And even if he's supposedly playing a good guy, he's always like a dirty cop, like we saw in like Beast Cops. It's very rare for him to just play an actual just genuinely good guy.
So, well, this is one of the things he had to fight against, because he was a half caste and has got quite European looks, is that he was always cast as the bad guy, and he's been quite a vocal fighter for to get rid of the institutional racism in Hong Kong cinema. So, yay, Anthony Wong!
Yeah, definitely. Right, your pick now, Stephen, I believe.
Yeah, so after Zoe's picked probably the classic of the extreme cinema in Asia, I'm going to go way back, and I'm going to go way back to 1965 and Masaki Kobayashi's Kwaidan, which is a collection of Japanese ghost stories, a portmanteau type film, and I love this in horror. This is one of the things I love about horror films, is that you get these portmanteau films, and it's not just in Asian cinema, but in obviously in the British cinema and American cinema, where you'll get a collection of stories. So Zoe already talked about the Three Extremes collection, where we get three of the greatest modern Asian directors making a small little films to give you one big package. Well, Quiet Dan's done by one guy. It adapts, I'm going to say, 3.5 popular Japanese ghost stories. And although as a package, it's a bit of a feast. I'll see your 150 minutes for The Wailing, and I'll raise you 182 minutes for this one. But you can watch all 3.5 films separately if you want to. The opening story, The Black Hair, that's where Sadako comes from, guys. That's where the long-haired ghost and the Asian, you'll see in a lot of Japanese and Korean films where hair seems to be very a signifier for ghostly and horrific events. So remember, we talked about XD last time. The grandfather of Sadako of the Ring, or XD, all that is, or the grandmother, I suppose, is the black hair. The other 3.5 stories are all equally good. It's a classic for a reason. The story behind it is even more fascinating. It nearly brought down Toho Studios. But you know, if we can go back, go to a bit of classic, let's go to Kwaidan.
Cool. It's unquestionably it's a classic. I mean, I think it's sort of fallen off the radar of some Asian horror viewers, but certainly one still worth discovering, as you said. I think it's responsible for so much within Asian horror. I mean, Zoe, have you heard of this one?
No, I haven't. I just looked it up, though, because obviously, like you were saying, there's the whole thing of the hair is a really big thing in kind of like Asian horror supernatural films. You know, even in like the Grudge, maybe it's not as relevant, but you know, when the hand comes out of her hair in the shower, you know, it kind of plays on the hair there. And I think there's another film called Hair Extensions or something ridiculous, like,
yeah, that's what we
goes on with the hair. So yeah, no, I'll definitely have to watch this.
Yeah, you'll often find, just before something spooky's happening, the girl will find some hair in the sink plug hole or something like that. And so water and hair are the two big signifiers in Asian cinema of ghostly events coming on.
That's why I cut all my hair off.
You see, now you mention hair in the plug hole, it just reminds me of my scummy old housemates.
Well, they were probably all ghosts, mate.
That's what it was, just not the fact that they were just pigs. So it's like, yeah, just what I need to deal with first thing in the morning is you and your lack of bathroom hygiene. The last selection for myself, it's going to seem like a bit much sort of like a throwaway sort of film, but it's actually a film I really try to recommend whenever I get the chance. That is the 2008 South Korean horror film Death Bell. Now, this is a film that's kind of like Saw in a way, in the fact that it's a group of students who are partaking in this elite class to prepare for a college exam, and they find themselves being targeted by this serial killer who forces them to solve problems, otherwise one of the group will die. And one of the things I love about Death Bell is the fact that it opens with this post-apocalyptic zombie sequence, which has nothing to do with the rest of the film, and features some of the most creative kills I've seen in Asian horror in a long time. We have someone who suffocated to death with candle wax, someone else is put into a washing machine, which is actually on the back of the DVD case, and when I was going through the films in Blockbuster was kind of what appealed to me to make me want to rent it, because sometimes you only need to see one shot from a film to, you know, see that, you know, this is something you want to check out, be it like the big bird coming behind the parachuting guy in the giant claw, or in this case, just someone inside a washing machine. I thought, well, you know, I've not seen that, and I think I would give that a go. So it turned out that Death Bell has a lot more to offer than that, and yeah, it's probably one of the more overlooked horror films, especially within the realm of like Korean horror. But it's certainly an enjoyable one and certainly worth checking out.
Do you know, it's funny, I saw you picked it as number one in our 31 day countdown. I thought, I can't believe you've even heard of it, because it's a little gem. I'm a big fan of the lead, well, sort of the lead actor, the guy I think he plays the main teacher. I knew him from a Korean drama, and to see him in that role was quite of a disturbing. But it's a bit of a battle royale kind of thing going on, isn't there? But it's a little underappreciated and underavailable gem.
Yeah. Zoe, should I ask, have you seen this one or?
No, I haven't seen this one, but you said it's similar to Battle Royale, and anything that's a hidden gem goes immediately on my to watch list. I mean, I've got many now from today, so I'm very much looking forward to it.
You can, of course, find a full list of all the films mentioned on tonight's show via our Letterboxd page. On Letterboxd as well, you find a list of every film we've covered on the show, including the further viewings as well. Links, of course, will be in the description section below. So there we have it. Obviously, our five picks each. Now, obviously, as we've obviously discovered as we've gone on, we've had to eliminate films from our list that didn't make the top five. So let's just have a quick rundown of your also-rans. I mean, is there any films that you wanted to include that obviously didn't make that final list?
So films that I wanted to include that I didn't include was Pulse, as we mentioned it. It is, as you said, Stephen, it's actually one of my all-time favourite horror films ever. But I speak about it so much that I left that one out. Ju-on, purely because it was the Asian horror film that first ever made me even know that that Asian horror films existed. Obviously, when I was young, I didn't know too much about cinema at all. Then there was Audition, but you mentioned that, so that was done. There was also the other two films from Three Extremes, which is Cut and Box, but I didn't love them as much as Dumpling, so I left those ones out. Another great one is Suicide Club. Thought that was very fucked up. And then the other one that I was going to go for was probably kind of the whole series, but in particular one, the Guinea Pig series. In particular, I love Flowers of Flesh and Blood purely for the effects, maybe not so much the storyline, because that doesn't really exist. But Guinea Pig series is, if you're looking to get into the kind of more extreme side of Asian cinema, it's a great place to start, and it's got comedy, it's got gore, it's got weirdness, it's got surreal, it's got gross, it's kind of got everything in there. So if you're ever looking to get into the more extreme side, I'd definitely say give that a go to start, see how you go with that.
Guinea Pigs series is just... There's some people who actually believe that it's an actual snuff film. Some of these, they got a code to one of them and thought it was an actual snuff film.
And I also forgot to mention, last night I, for the first time, took me a long time, but I finally saw I Saw the Devil, and that was amazing.
That's hilarious. That's on my also ran list.
Yes. And I also I tried to get my boyfriend to watch Itchy the Killer, but after we watched the trailer, he decided that was not what we were going to watch, so we settled on I Saw the Devil, but it was a good choice.
What, your boyfriend didn't want to watch the letters of the film being marked out in cum?
No. He said that was not what he was not feeling for a Wednesday night, so you know. Maybe next week.
Maybe You should show him Dead or Alive, also by Takashi Miike. The opening 15 minutes alone is makes that film worthwhile.
I'll see if I can convince him.
Stephen, also Rans, where do you want to include?
Right, deep breath. if you're gonna link all these. No, so obviously we talked about Pulse. Obviously both of Zoe and I missed a chance there to advertise that one, but also have a look at Kurosawa's Cure, which is the film he made just before Pulse, which is a film about a serial killer. Talking of serial killers, I Saw the Devil is fucking brilliant and is the best serial killer film ever, and is a good partner to the Vengeance trilogy in a way, because when you go for revenge, dig your own grave and all that. There's a Thai film called Ladderland, which is well worth hunting down, which is a ghost story with a social conscience. I talked about it before in one of our previous podcasts, Bedeviled, which is another great female-based revenge, quite gory South Korean film. Ghost stories, obviously I talked a lot about ghost stories. One of the best is a film called The Discarnates, which is by Nobuhiko Obayashi, who's quite a famous director, but it's a really touching ghost story. It's not scary, but it's touching, and it's about family and lost potential. We talked a little bit about what directors we go to for horror films, and I sort of kept my powder dry, but I forgot about the Pang brothers. So most people think that they only really did The Eye, which is a pretty classic horror film of Asian, or sorry, a pretty classic Asian horror film, if I get my teeth in. However, they may suffer a bit from M. Night Shyamalan-itis, in the sense that everyone thinks all their other films are no good. But I'd seriously recommend In Love with the Dead and Abnormal, which is quite disturbing. In the old black and white, there were horror films before colour cinema came along. Do check out Kuroneko and Onibaba, both Japanese films that show you that black and white can be bloody scary. And we've got to talk about Houseu, which is the most mental bonkers horror film, musical, weird, experimental thing you'll ever see, and it's also fantastic.
Yes. Just, of course, they're trying to write these all down as you reel them off. I mean, you know that they've got like 500 syllables to some of these things, so.
Oh, I can send you them all. Yeah. In a list.
You know, Letterboxd only searches so quick as I'm trying to do this. Okay. Right. Just looking at what's obviously left, because you both have scratched some things off the list. I'm going to start with Confession. Again, that's another really great thriller that runs right through to the end. Another favourite, and I'm surprised it didn't actually come up, which we've obviously talked about a little bit earlier in the episode, and that would be Dark Water by Hideo Nakata, his follow-up to Ring. And bar the how it ends, I think it's an absolute solid ghost story all the way through. I think if you enjoy The Ring, then Dark Water is a perfect companion piece. Slightly lighter tack, it would be Biozombie, a film which actually opens like you're watching a pirated video. So it's shot so you think they've actually filming it in the cinema, so you see tops of people's heads, and have what sounds like people in the audience complaining about the film. Biozombie is an absolutely fantastic Asian zombie movie, which I can't say there's a huge amount of, which makes it only all the more special, but it's really funny, really violent, and worth checking out for that fact alone. Tetsu, The Iron Man. Again, this is a really experimental film, but the fact it features a raging drill penis, as well as other Cronenberg-style bodily mutations, as makes it just absolutely bonkers and wonderfully insane. The fact that it spawned two sequels as well, is something of a surprise, but the original, I think if you like the original, then you probably enjoy the sequels as well. My final sort of pick for the evening, of course, would be Save the Green Planet. A film which I think it falls in that grey area, whether is it a thriller, is it a horror film? Certainly for myself, and certainly as it goes on, it becomes more of a horror film and less of the light-hearted comedy that it starts off as. But yeah, Save the Green Planet, where we have this seemingly nice guy who believes that this head of a big industry is actually an alien, and sets out to prove his cause by kidnapping him and torturing him using his own twisted sort of logic, is a really underappreciated film, and definitely one still worth discovering now. But yeah, those are obviously our picks. You can find the full list, including the also rans, on Letterboxd, which we will put the link in the description below. So make sure you go and check it out there. And also check out our complete film list of films we have covered on the show today as well. I'd like to thank Zoe, obviously, for coming on and sharing her picks and shocking us, perhaps, with some of her taste.
Thank you for letting me come on and scare people, as always.
If people want to obviously come and find your work and see just how deep the rabbit hole goes, where's the best place to come and find you?
The best place to find me is, of course, sobowithashotgun.com. You can also find me tweeting on Twitter about strange movies I've watched that I might have not got the time to fully review, seeing as I'm currently spending my life packing boxes at the moment. Or you can find me over at the Horrorcist, currently slating many indie films that I've watched lately, which I feel awful about, but I've seen some awful, awful films which I've completely slated. So if you're into that, you can also find me over there.
Nice. Stephen, if people obviously want to come and find your bits, where can they still find you now?
Well, I will start writing again for guerrerambling.wordpress.com, but I am pumping out some regular stuff still at easternkicks.com.
Awesome. As for myself, as well as our site and sponsor, thatmomentin.com, where you can currently not only read my Movie Tourist series, which recently looked at the Monster Islands from the Godzilla franchise, as well as Pigsty Alley from Kung Fu Hustle. You can read my blog from the thedvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. Also on Twitter, which is at Elwood_Jones. Again, for the show, please come follow us on Facebook, or follow us now on Twitter, which is at AC Film Club. Let us know your favourite Asian horror movies, or your thoughts on Asian cinema in general. The email is open as well, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. And if you haven't done already, please do subscribe. Leave us a rating on iTunes, which is under Asian Cinema Film Club, or also on Podomatic as well. We have got those independent feeds just for this show all up and running now. So please go show us some support and let us know what you think about the show. But again, thank you to our special guest tonight, Zoe Rose Smith from Zoboa Shotgun, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, of course, as always, to my partner in crime, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Thank you for having me, and happy Halloween, everybody.
And this is Edward Jones, signing off another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Thank you again for listening. Hey! 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 Kinono-ko-hi-wa-wasurete Odori tsuzukete itai yoru nano sa tsuki ga kudake chittemo hoshi ga moete ochitemo odori tsuzukete itai yoru nano sa mune ni sasatta koi no yaiba ga moeru omoi wo Kinono-ko-hi-wa-wasurete
恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。